Right, so that's everything. I'll hand over to John Stiles, who've got from the University of Hertfordshire, talking to us today on fashion.
Well, thank you. Well, it's very nice to be here, speaking next to where I spent many hours sitting in the Seeley Library when it was only young. Loved isn't the right word. I worked in the Seeley Library very often because it was the most uncomfortable library in Cambridge. And therefore, when revising for Tripos, it was the one place where I didn't fall asleep. I won't fall asleep today. Okay, well, fashion and fibres in 18th century England. Well, Amy and I are going to talk around various aspects of fashion in the long 18th century today. We're taking it from slightly different angles. I'm going to talk more about the relationship between fashion as consumption and fashion as production, and particularly about fabrics. And I know she's going to talk more about questions of identity. So I hope the two papers will complement each other and also explore all sorts of different aspects of the subject. I'm particularly anxious not to talk about fashion as identity, because I have a slight beef with fashion as identity at the moment. I mean, fashion is obviously about identity. The clothes one wears, and insofar as we're talking about fashion in clothing, are inextricably linked to the body, about displaying it, concealing it, manipulating it, etc., etc., etc. You know the screed. But it does seem to me that in the last 20 years, fashion has become academically enormously successful. It's a real growth area. It's moved from being denigrated. I mean, the professors who taught me when I was trying to avoid falling asleep in the Seeley Library would have regarded an interest in fashion from one of the historians as rather frivolous. Now I think fashion is much more centre stage in humanities in general than it was there. Then, but it's achieved that partly because of a focus on identity. I mean, if you look, the major publisher of works, academic works, scholarly works on fashion at the moment is Berg. And if you look at the Berg list, you'll see it's absolutely dominated by questions around fashion and identity. If you look at the manifesto which Fashion Theory, also published by Berg, publishes on their website, it says, "Fashion theory takes as its starting point a definition of fashion as the cultural construction of the embodied identity. The importance of studying the body as a site for the deployment of discourses has been well established in a number of disciplines." Until fashion theory, this hadn't had enough critical analysis. And now, it says, increasingly scholars have recognised the cultural significance of self-fashioning, including not only clothing, but also body alterations like tattooing and piercing. So there's their statement. It's at the core of this approach is identity. Now, as I said, that's obviously important. But in today's talk, I want to rather move the focus away from that and think more about fashion in terms of change, in terms of production and consumption, in terms of the economics of fashion, and fashion and time. I mean, to me, that's the element that's getting left out at the moment, that there's a sense in which fashion is about change, the organisation of material things through time, and that's currently getting slightly downplayed relative to questions of fashion and identity. The two are inextricably linked, of course, but there's a difference of emphasis, and as a historian, and many of those I see in the audience are historians, it seems to me, do have a responsibility to think about change through time. Okay, but today I'm going to talk about cotton, and this rather unprepossessing little swatch of fabric, which is from the Foundling textiles, mid-18th century Foundling textiles, from the Foundling Hospital in London, is a piece of plain white calico. In this case, almost certainly made in India, hand-spun, and it came to the hospital undyed, unprinted. Now, cotton, of which this is a mundane, everyday example, as we all know, dominated the Industrial Revolution of the 18th century. As Eric Hobsbawm famously said, whoever says Industrial Revolution says cotton. But cotton also dominated many discussions and many historians' analyses of 18th century fashion and textiles. It certainly was the coming fabric of the 18th century. And Beverly Lemire has said that that cotton fabrics indeed inaugurated fashion-driven popular consumerism in the course of the late 17th and 18th centuries. So both from the production point of view and from the consumption point of view, cotton plays a central role in any consideration of textiles fashion in the 18th century. Now, what I'm going to do today is bring these two together, fashion as consumption and fashion as production. And not, as I said, say so much about fashion as identity. And the first question I want to ask is, what was cotton for? What was cotton for in the 18th century? Why was this a commodity that, as Eric Hobsbawm said, sparked industrial revolution, that sparked a kind of democratization of fashion? Well, if we think of 18th century fashion, this is the sort of thing we think of. These are exquisitely expensive silk gowns from the Kyoto costume, the marvelous Kyoto costume collection, of the sort that were worn in the middle years of the 18th century by the very richest ladies, lords and women, ladies in this case, in both cases made in Spitalfields in London in very short, small runs. When we think about what ordinary people wore, we think more in terms of this sort of thing. Here's two servants working, washing near Windsor, with plain, probably woolen garments, dyed coloured, but not nothing very fancy. And even plainer, the servant on the right wearing a patched petticoat, a coarse striped bedgown tied loosely with a ribbon, in contrast to the eloping lady who's dressed in her silk finery. So the fabrics that we generally think of as being available to poorer people in the period are this sort of thing. Worsted stuffs, patterned, perfectly attractive, but nothing to compare with those silks we saw earlier. There's a version in stripes. Now, cotton promised to transform what ordinary people could wear, principally because it was capable of being printed with a range of fast colours in a way that had not been possible previously. These patterns are all woven. But here we have a cotton printer printing the colour onto the surface of a length of cotton. Printing could be done on wool. Here's a piece of printed flannel. But as you see, the take of the dyes on the surface of the fabric is not very effective. On cotton, by contrast, the effects can be absolutely gorgeous. This is an Indian chintz. The technique of printing fast colours on these fabrics was an Indian technique which was brought to Europe with considerable difficulty and only perfected in its European guise gradually over the later 17th and first half of the 18th century. Here you see printed on cotton. Here you see printing on linen, because the technique is not confined to cotton. You can print very effectively on linen. Printing in single colours here on cotton. Printing in single colour on linen. Now, this is a very expensive Spitalfields silk of the 1750s from the National Trust collection in Northern Ireland. As you can see, it has these lovely brocaded effects, gold thread, silver thread, vibrant colours. This is the sort of thing that only the richest people could afford. Here you see a caricature of a woman street seller in London dressed in a bedgown. The idea that it looks nothing like the silk you saw just before, but if you look closely, the kind of patterning is exactly, is reminiscent, that what we're talking about here is an attempt to not recreate the look of this, that would be impossible, but to echo it, to draw on it, to evoke it. It's that same sort of a creamy yellow background with these little devices scattered across it, and that could only be cheaply achieved by printing on cotton or linen, and what Colette's trying to suggest here, I think, is exactly that, a cotton or linen printed bedgown. Here we have, to take a point further about the way the design of the cotton, the printed cottons and printed linens mimics, evokes, draws on high fashion in its most expensive guise. Here we have an expensive flowered Spitalfields dress silk of about 1750, very, very beautifully woven in this pattern with a rosebud, and with a matching piece of fly braid, which is also very expensive material. Here we have, from the same founding collection, exactly the same motif printed on cotton. And there are the two together. Now, Neil McKendrick used to quote people from the 18th century who said, you know, the servant wanted to look like the Duchess. I don't think the servant may have wanted to look like the Duchess, although I'm not convinced she did. But the servant, no one would have mistaken the servant for the Duchess. It's inconceivable. These do not look the same. Nevertheless, the one evokes the other, as you can clearly see. So the whole point is that this technique allowed very often quite poor women to evoke, embrace elements of high fashion, although clearly never in a way that would ever lead them to be mistaken for a very rich lady who could afford a Spitalfields silk. But I think those two images make the point pretty clearly. And in other ways, there were cruder designs which also connect with high fashion. If you think the 1740s and 50s, the era of Rococo, here you have a pattern that's printed pattern that's called shelled. And here you actually have a shell. Also, these frond-like patterns are very popular in silks in the mid-18th century. And here you have one printed very crudely on cotton. And you can see the sort of pattern if you look behind the belligerent Englishman and the effete Frenchman to the woman who's looking rather quizzically at his pigtail. You can see this sort of same pattern on the woman there, and that's probably intended to suggest one of these fabrics, cotton printed fabrics. And some of these fabrics are extremely, extremely crude and simple. Now, there may have been a democratisation of fashion as a result of the coming of printed cotton and linen fabrics, but I don't. If there was, it was a slow process. There's been much talk of a calico craze in the late 17th century, and certainly there was a great deal of pamphleteering, heavily funded pamphleteering, around the politics of import controls, Indian cotton, English silks, English woolens. But I think these figures for theft from the Old Bailey make it clear that the number of cotton gowns, some of which would have been printed, not all, and linen gowns, some of which would have been printed, but not all, only grows relatively slowly as one moves through the late 17th and early 18th century. It's not clear to me, anyway, that Indian cottons make a huge and decisive inroad into the market for women's clothing in the late 17th century, as some of the pamphleteers claimed. That's not to say they weren't visible and considered important and challenging, but in terms of the sheer the actual numbers, their impact was slow. And cumulative, it's only really by the 1750s that you see really large numbers of stolen cotton gowns, linen gowns, outnumbering some of the various alternatives. Well, back to our expensive Spitalfield silk of the 1750s. What I want to do now is to talk briefly about design, specifically, and particularly about the relationship between India and Britain. Cotton, particularly the sort of printed cottons we've been talked about, were associated in the 17th and early 18th century mind inextricably with India. They were seen as very much Indian fabrics. And yet the way these things, to succeed in an English fashion market, they had to more or less conform to the dictates of the European fashion cycle. And this is very much high European fashion of the mid-18th century in the design of the fabric. Characteristics, white ground or cream ground, pattern made up of naturalistic elements, flowers, sheaths, and so on, scattered quite loosely by the 1750s across the white ground, with quite large spaces in between. That wouldn't have been true, say, 30 years earlier, but by this period you're getting this this kind of sparse effect. This is an Indian printed cotton coverlet of the mid to late 17th century in the V&A's collection, made for a Western Indian market, to be sold in the Deccan. It's characteristic of a great deal of Indian printed fabrics in that it's on a red ground. The ground is predominantly red. That didn't go down well in England. It went down slightly better in Holland for reasons I don't think very well understood, but it certainly didn't go down very well in England. And so to make this sort of thing saleable in England, the East India Company sent out designs to India to be made up according to an aesthetic formula that accorded with predominant English taste. And predominant English taste in textiles was very, very heavily influenced by the very long-standing traditions of European silk making and this preference for light, white or cream grounds. And that's what all the people intervening in these markets tried to supply. So this is an Indian chintz from the 1750s, again, on a white ground. This is, I suppose, the obvious British competition. It's a piece of Irish lawn printed in London with, again, flowers on a white ground. And even something like this, which was contrived to look quite, as we might say, Indian, is on a white ground. Ditto. I mean, some red ground fabrics were sent from India. Here's a chintz in the 1750s, probably Indian, on a red ground. And occasionally linen is printed with a red ground, but it's relatively rare. Of all the fabrics I've seen in various sources, I've been looking at the Foundling collection from the 1750s, at patchwork quilts, which are a kind of archive of materials, and pattern books, and so on and so forth. This European, particularly British preference for a white ground is predominant. So the technique of printing with fast colours may come from India, but the aesthetic is very much one that's developed, that draws on European and English models and is then extended and developed in England and imposed by the English East Indian Company on its Indian manufacturers. So that's, if you like, the fashion aspect of cotton, and particularly of printing on cottons and linens. We're talking about a huge success. There is a democratisation of a certain sort of fashion in fabrics by means of printing, and much of that printing is done on cotton and linen. So that this Indian technique is translated to England, and in the process changed to accord with English fashion, and off it goes. And of course, the final point I should stress, going back to Hobsbawm, all this happens before the initial inventions of the Industrial Revolution, Arkwright's water frame, Hargreaves' spinning jenny, and the like. But so that's, if you like, that's what cotton was for. And I think it's worth stressing as well that cotton isn't used much at this date for utilitarian purposes like sheets and shirts and shifts, contrary to what a lot of the textbooks on the Industrial Revolution claim. And there's a very simple reason for that. Cotton is a much weaker fabric than linen. And it's really only by the 1830s and 40s when cotton prices are something like yardage prices are a third or even a quarter of linen yardage prices that cotton begins to replace linen in those areas. And that's because it just doesn't last long enough. In other words, you're paying, because cotton wears out, remember how people wash things like sheets and shirts at this period, it's pretty brutal. And various early 19th century authors claim that linen lasts 3 to 4 times as long as cotton in sheeting and shirting. So it's really only till price of cotton becomes so cheap that it can undercut linen despite the fact that it has to be replaced more often, that it really takes over in those markets. Cotton's success at this early period is predominantly as a fashion fabric. It's not even that it's cheaper than many of the alternatives, it's that it's more fashionable, and for the reasons I've just gone into, it can carry a look more effectively, the look, the desirable, the fashionable look. But let me now turn to my second question. And the second question is, what is this cotton? When we say cotton, what do we mean by cotton? I've already pointed out that a lot of the printing, as in this case, is not done on cotton, but on linen. You can print on linen almost as effectively, in some instances more effectively, than on cotton. So a lot of the fashion impact is actually not to do with the fabric, with the fibre, cotton. It's to do with the technique of printing patterns in fast colours on a plain surface textile. And that could be linen, it could be cotton. So when we talk about cotton, when Hobsbawm talks about, when we say the Industrial Revolution, you mean cotton, what is this cotton? What is cotton? Okay, well let's now turn to that question and think about fibres. This is a piece of what's called flowered chintz from the Foundling collection from 1759. So it probably was made sometime in the previous decade. We don't know exactly when. But this is the decade before the inventions of the Industrial Revolution. It almost certainly came from India, was made in India. And when one looks at it through a microscope at 60 times magnification, what you see is it's all cotton. So what the warp, the warp and the weft, both are cotton. It's cotton, as they said in the 18th century, both ways. Because in India, cotton is grown in India, it's processed in India, it's woven in India, it's printed in India, and then it's shipped to England. That's all cotton. Look at greater magnification, you can see it's got this slightly furry effect which cotton has under the microscope. Let's go a bit further. Now here you have another example from the Foundling collection, two fabrics here. On top is, ignore the embroidery. This is embroidery on a piece of calico. It's worked. That means it's embroidered. But behind is what is called a purple flowered cotton, by which they mean the Clark meant cotton. So you have a printed cotton behind, and you have a flowered calico on which embroidery has been done. Again, the calico, when they say calico in these documents, they almost always mean Indian. When they say cotton, they generally mean something made in England. Let's look at the calico under the microscope. Again, it's looser than the chintz, but it's cotton both ways. It's got that furriness of cotton. So this is an Indian fabric made out of cotton woven in Western India or in the area in Southeastern India, we don't know. Now let's look at this one. I've pulled this back, and now you can see the flowered cotton, as it's called. Now, this is rather different from either of those previous Indian examples. First of all, this is the warp. It's not cotton. that's Lily. And then secondly, this is the weft, and that is cotton, but look how coarse it is compared with what you saw in the Indian examples. It's coarse, it's also not twisted very tightly. The cotton by this period almost certainly came from the West Indies. It's New World cotton. And with then the spun and then woven in England. The linen was spun, was grown as flax and spun in the Baltic, in Poland, Lithuania, Russia, and then imported. And so why is it like this? Why isn't it cotton both ways? It's called cotton, as you saw. Why is half of it linen? Well, it's often said that half of it's linen because the British government banned all cotton fabrics in 1721, a ban which remained until Mr. Arkwright paid very heavily to have it overturned in 1774. But that's not strictly true. There is no time in the period from the late Middle Ages when cotton fabrics really start being made in Europe until the late 18th century when Europeans are capable of making fabrics with cotton warps. Almost all the cotton fabrics made in Europe before the 1770s have linen warps. In other words, they're only half cotton. And that's not because of the law, it's because for reasons we don't understand, it seems to be very hard for Europeans to make all cotton fabrics. So they don't. They put linen in, a European fibre, which they understand. And that, I think, I mean, there's various explanations, but I think a key explanation is that European looms work at a much higher tension than most Indian looms. And the warp is the bit that sits in the loom and carries the tension. And it's hard to make cotton warps that will carry the tension. I don't think the Europeans know how to do it, particularly with the very short staple Indian and Middle Eastern cotton that they have available early on. So this is a different beast from the cotton, the Indian cottons you saw before. And that's back to the two we're looking at. This is the Indian, this is the British. And there you see them together. And you can see the difference, really. That's the calico, cotton both ways. That's the English-made cotton fabric. Cotton one way, linen the other. Now, the fact that so much of this is made in England does have something to do with the legislation I spoke about before, because the British ban the importing of this. As you see, it's still got through to London in a few cases, which is why I was able to photograph it. But they banned this in order to facilitate the manufacture of silks and woolens and, to some extent, this sort of thing, which, because it was only half cotton, got under the ban. That wasn't true in America, where the ban didn't apply. So in America, if you look at all these fabrics, this is an order from 1726, from a New York merchant. These are all printed on all cotton Indian fabrics, but probably printed in London. And the same was true 20 years later, when the same merchant was ordering from England. So where there's no legal constraints in the British Empire, i.e. in New York, these people say, we want it on the Indian fabric. The Indian fabric is better. It's cotton both ways. It's a better product. But in the absence, when the legislation applied and you had to make it in Europe, you made it like that. And most of those printed fabrics we saw earlier, that I showed you earlier, are on that sort of fabric. It's the English-made fabric. Well, where does this take us? Well, this takes us straight to the names of the machines many of you will have learned at school: Arkwright's spinning frame, Hargreaves' spinning jenny, and eventually Samuel Compton's spinning mule. There's been a lot of endless economic history debate about why these things are invented, and it goes on. There's a recent Bob Allen article in the Journal of Economic History about that machine, about Hargreaves' spinning jenny. What few of these people actually point out is that this machine spinning Jenny is important, but it can only spin weft, those fluffy yarns we saw in the fabric. What's utterly revolutionary is this machine, Arkwright's water frame, because Arkwright's water frame produced cotton warps. In other words, it overturns 400 years of European cotton making, cotton fabric making, because for the first time it allows Europeans to make fabrics that are all cotton. So these fabrics stop being half linen, half cotton, and become all cotton. In other words, what was cotton changes. And the revolutionary aspect of Arkwright's machine is not, as most economic historians seem to persist in saying, the fact that it massively increases productivity. It did, output per worker. It certainly did. But I don't think that's the absolutely core of what Arkwright was trying to achieve. The core of what Arkwright was trying to achieve was to enable the British, Europeans in general, and the English in particular, to make all cotton fabrics. And all cotton fabrics for this fashion market, because all cotton fabrics could be printed on and carry the colour generally better than linen. This is this quote from a Bedfordshire gentlewoman in 1776, shortly after the Arkwright fabrics come on stream. She said, she asked a friend in London to get her, quote, one of the new manufactory which are cotton both ways, have sent a pattern. It is a great deal lighter than a cotton, and the colours look more lively. So she's, you know, in her letter, there are two sorts of cotton, both of which have the same name. One of them is the old cotton, which has a linen warp and is heavier and doesn't take the colour as well. The other is the new cotton produced with Arkwright's twist, and the warp was known as twist, which is lighter, because linen is heavier than cotton in general, and the colours look better. In other words, that fashion element, that the colours should look good, that's what you want a cotton fabric for if you're a Bedfordshire gentlewoman in the 1770s. So it's my contention that in all this, that what's driving Richard Arkwright is fashion, is the demand for cotton as a fashion fabric, and the problem that Europeans in general and British in particular have in making cottons to the standard that it's made by in India. So in a sense, what we're talking about is something rather like the history of European porcelain, that it's what we're seeing here is an attempt to develop a technology that will produce something that previously Europeans have been unable to produce, cotton warps. And so it's mechanization that's about quality as much, if not more, than about quantity. And as Maxine Berg, who's at the back there, has said, you know, it's about product innovation leading to process innovation. It's not just about a kind of, and we shouldn't think of this simply in terms of a kind of Marxian triumph of machine over worker, although that may have been one of the inevitable consequences of what Arkwright invented. So by around 1780, things are beginning to change. This is the book of fabric swatches that was put together by the daughter of an English clergyman in Bedfordshire called Barbara Johnson. And this is one of the first all cotton English fabrics she puts in her book. And she says, an English chintz. In other words, it's not an Indian chintz, it's an English chintz. And it's an English chintz because it's made, it's cotton both ways, warp and weft, made and printed in England. It's new. She's registering the novelty. Now, at this stage in the 1780s, it takes time for this new approach to manufacturing printed cotton fabrics to take hold. This is a page from a pattern book of a Manchester merchant 2 years later in 1783. These printed fabrics are all on the old linen cotton mix. Cottons. Sorry, it's so confusing. So the Arkwright invention doesn't, it takes time, but by the time this is a piece of patchwork, this is a patchwork quilt from 1802, all those fabrics are cotton both ways, made in England, except one. And you know, a patchwork quilt is like a little archive, probably reflects the previous 10 or 15 years of output. It's quite hard for us now to tell which one is the cotton linen as opposed to the old cotton. It's that one. That one is cotton and linen. All the rest are pure cotton. So, to conclude, by the end of the story, by the end of the 18th century, we reach a world where this is still available, still being made. But whereas the one, when I spoke to you about this at the beginning of the talk, I was saying this is a piece of calico, spun in India, woven in India, made from Indian cotton, almost certainly locally produced in the areas concerned. You could have something that would have looked almost precisely the same by 1800, but it would have been made of cotton grown in the West Indies or the new United States. It would have been spun by machine all in Lancashire or possibly Scotland or Derbyshire with one of the Arkwright machines and would have been woven in England. And I hope what I've tried to show is the way that fashion drove that transformation, and that it became, and it was a transformation which, although this is an all cotton cloth, was actually for most English consumers a transformation. Exactly what cotton was in its very physicality was transformed by new technologies. Thank you.
I'd like to add a caveat with this paper, which is not only is it about identity, but when I was writing it, I realised that as I'm talking about the Royal Navy quite a bit, I didn't want to assume prior knowledge on it, because having said that, before I was at the Maritime Museum, I had no prior knowledge on the Royal Navy, so... This paper is a lot about context and perhaps less about fashion, but I am hoping that the elements of fashion do come out in the discussion. So I wanted to start with this quite stunning image, literally, of the destruction of the Lorient, which is from the Battle of the Nile in 1798, and it was painted by George Arnold between 1825 and 27. And certainly, in terms of my second caveat is actually in terms of this being about the long 18th century, I have taken that quite literally, and this really is the tail end of what we consider the long 18th century, which is in effect the 19th century. So, during the period of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, so roughly 1792-1815, the Royal Navy really came to hold an iconic place in British society. And there are three really primary reasons why this occurs. The first is that it's a period of almost continual warfare, and the Navy became the largest employer in Britain. They supported a vast network of crews, dockyards, administrators, and suppliers. Secondly, advancement in the Navy differed from that in the Army, because you didn't purchase a commission the way that you did in the Army. You could, in theory, advance through merit, although social connections were desirable. And this meant that there was the possibility that really anyone could work their way up the ranks to achieve wealth, and if you were talented enough, a peerage. And finally, it's a period of great victories, particularly the Battle of the Nile, which is shown here, which annihilated the French fleet. This had such an impact that the Morning Post and Gazetteer noted in November of 1798 that almost all the noble families in the country have sons or brothers in the Navy, as it has now become more fashionable to enter that service than to enter the army. Now, of course, the most famous battle of this period, well, naval engagement of this period, is the Battle of Trafalgar in October 1805, and this is Turner's quite unforgettable image of it. And in this battle, it effectively defeated the French and Spanish fleets. This in turn meant that Napoleon abandons his maritime ambition, and Britain, in effect, holds an unchallenged supremacy over the seas. The Navy are seen as the saviours of both trade and empire. And however, though, Trafalgar comes at a cost. And it's the loss at the moment of victory of the man many consider Britain's greatest naval hero, Horatio Nelson. Now, of course, if he is celebrated in life, he is positively deified in death. And literally, this is the apotheosis of Nelson by the Grand from 1807. And Nelson is buried at the centre of St. Paul's, which is really a pantheon for the heroes of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. The country, of course, is plunged into national mourning, and the officers of the Navy, who, interestingly, against all protocol, are given the role of chief mourners at Nelson's state funeral. And it's interesting to note, Nelson is only the third commoner to have a state funeral. The other two, just for interest, were Admiral Blake and Isaac Newton. They were also, the Navy, as not only being his chief mourners, are also viewed as heirs to his genius. And this is a legacy that actually proves a bit of a burden to the Navy in the ensuing years, literally the post-Trafalgar years. And part of this is because the Navy, well, more specifically its officers, are problematical as masculine types, occupying the role of national heroes. And you can see this in this Rowlandson print. This is Portsmouth Point from 1811. And you can see the impression people have of the Navy. Their course, their base, they're seen as separate from society, quite literally, because they spend great periods of time in enforced absences on long voyages. Cook, for example, has gone for years on his voyages of discovery in the 1770s. Collingwood, who is second in command at Trafalgar, actually never saw his family. So you do have this issue. And part of the reason they're seen, not only because they're on long voyages and so separate from society, but also it's felt they're very coarse and base because of being so long in the sole company of other men. Now, what's interesting is in the post-Trafalgar period, they undergo a period of modernization, both technologically as we move from sail to steam, but also organizationally. And so what I'm looking at really is the role that fashion, and to a certain extent, these changes, specifically around education, play in remolding naval officers to be appropriate exemplars of masculine identity, and the impact that this has on popular public perceptions. Now, while Trafalgar is the last major naval engagement of the Napoleonic Wars, as I said, I didn't want to presuppose prior knowledge. I wanted to give a quick overview of what the Navy is actually doing after 1805, and their big thing is Arctic exploration. This is the Ross expedition from 1818, and you can see them in their spiffy uniforms meeting the Inuit. And under the aegis of Sir John Barrow, the second Secretary of the Admiralty, polar exploration was a major focus in the post-Waterloo period, really until the mid-1840s. Other duties included protecting convoys of merchant ships, particularly those bound for the West Indies. So all that lovely cotton that's coming in is being protected by the Navy. They also did anti-piracy actions and the suppression of the slave trade, as that was declared illegal by British government in 1807. Now, military engagements of the period included the War of 1812, and this didn't really enhance the Navy's reputation greatly, as they were effectively held to a stalemate by a much newer force. And their big set-piece battle is this, the Battle of Navarino in 1827, which was to a certain extent an inadvertent victory in that it was to do with Greek independence, and you had a Turkish and Egyptian fleet in the harbour at Navarino, and Codrington entered the harbour with a combined fleet of the French, Russians and British. And at some point, someone fired a pistol, which, given the acoustics of the harbour, made everyone think they were being fired on, and the whole thing just went off as a battle. Codrington was actually court-martialed. The Admiralty felt that he deliberately provoked the situation, and they did reluctantly clear him of charges. But the victory wasn't enthusiastically reported in the British press, particularly the Times, were quite backhanded about it. What this really does illustrate, quite interestingly, is that the Royal Navy of 1827 was, in popular public opinion, not as strong as Nelson's Navy of 1805. And you can see Nelson just trundles on throughout the century. This is an 1829 print, so really just after Navarino. It's done after a portrait by Hoppner, and with his signature below, well, a copy of it below. And it is one of those things that Nelson is consistently one of these great heroes that's always held up throughout the 19th century, really almost against what is seen as a perceived decline in the Navy. And this decline is discussed at length in pamphlets and tracts throughout the first half of the 19th century. It was, in fact, very much a part of public debate. In terms of popular culture, Nelson's Navy was repeatedly memorialized in novels really from the 1820s until the Crimean War in the mid-1850s. Now, in late December 1827, the Lord High Admiral, the future William IV, introduced new uniform regulations, and these marked a clear break with those worn from 1821. You can see here, and I'll just talk a bit about these. This is the 1821 pattern. This is the new uniform. I apologize for the portrait. It's been done from a photo in our store, so it's not brilliant. It's my own work. I'm sorry. But what you can see here is this really owes more, in terms of fashion, to the 18th century. You've got the button back white lapel, the standing collar, this cuff, which is that when uniform regulations come in 1748, it's a really lovely, large boot cuff. What it becomes is shrunk down into being this tiny, tight cuff, which happens over the second half of the 18th century, with the three buttons here that it's still holding from 1748. So essentially, medieval fashion is really quite stagnant. It's quite fossilized. What you get in this is a double-breasted coat. It still retains the standing collar, but in effect, it's pulling more in line with contemporary fashion. And if you look, unfortunately you can't see, but it is a cutaway. The other thing that they introduce into uniform regulations, which you can't believe they've made it into 1821 without it, is that he's still wearing breeches, whereas he actually wears trousers. So they really do move on from the 18th century in terms of fashion. While the new uniform radically altered the appearance of the Navy, it gave them really a more streamlined, modern dress that served to clothe all officers in more or less the same thing. Before that, you really do have quite a big differentiation in rank based on the style of your uniform and the lace and all of that. So once you get a promotion, because clothing is so expensive, you would simply just take your old uniform to your tailor and have them alter the bits that they needed to do. Having said that, again, because clothing is so expensive, the Navy's not terribly happy that they have to pay for an entirely new set of clothes. And you can see these are from 1830, and these are showing the illustrations of the new uniform. And it's one of the few times that the uniform is actually being illustrated once you get into the 19th century. Before that, they described what it was supposed to look like. A set of sealed patterns or made-up clothes were available at the various dockyards, and your tailor was meant to copy that out. So you have a lot of variations in uniform. At this time, you do get, as uniform should become, more uniform. The interesting thing about this that I love about these particular prints is these were distributed throughout the Admiralty, specifically to officers. But what you do see is they're mimicking fashion plates. So if you look at a period text like the Gentleman's Magazine of Fashion from the period, they're shown leaning against things. This is worn open, which is against regulations, but you can see the waistcoat, you can see his cravat, you can see the way his clothes are supposed to hang and how he's supposed to look. In this case, he's leaning up against a bit of ship. In one case, they're leaning against cannon, instead of, in the Gentleman's Magazine of Fashion, more artfully draped.
But the thing that you should take from this as well is that these uniforms are very similar. This is a lieutenant, or very similar rather. This is a lieutenant. This is a rear admiral. And the only differentiation that you should see is between the width of lace on the trouser legs and on the collar and also with their epaulettes. So that will tell you the difference. But other than that, they really are very nearly identical. Now, the interesting thing about the uniform change is it didn't apply to everyone. Only commissioned officers. So in the Navy at that period, the commissioned officer is lieutenant, captain, commander, and the various ranks of admiral. And that's because your commission comes from the king. Beneath that, you get warrant officers who are officers with special skills. So that's mates who specialise in navigation, it's surgeons and physicians, gunners, carpenters, pursers who do essentially the books on a ship. They don't get a new uniform until the 1830s. And the ratings, who are called that, the sailors, because they're rated according to their abilities, they don't get a uniform until 1857, so a full 100 years after a uniform is first introduced in the Navy. Now, the new patterns of 1827 were not universally well received. Sir Thomas Bynoe Martin, who was an admiral of the fleet, who began his career in 1786 as a captain servant to Prince William, confronted the prince over the new uniform. And he wrote in his memoirs that, when the alterations took place, I was too sulky to keep my opinion to myself, and told the Lord High Admiral, I thought it would be distasteful to the whole service. He assured me he had nothing to do with the change, and I said he had the credit of being the author of it. Unfortunately, there are no extant records to indicate who initiated it or what the aims were. Now, in the absence of documentation, one of the things that you can look at with the change is to examine its cultural context. And I mentioned that the Navy were difficult masculine role models, as they were seen as coarse and unmannered. And one way to deal with this was to change their appearance. Certainly, there is a long-standing link between dress and morality that appropriate, and to a certain extent, sober dress is indicative of a moral rightness. And it's interesting to note that throughout the 1820s, so the years immediately preceding the change, the overwhelming concern expressed in popular tracts and pamphlets in regard to the Navy was the moral condition of its officers. One pamphleteer who signed himself an old naval surgeon wrote in 1824 that it is not my intention to approach the Admiralty on the subject. This is about young boys going to sea at a very early age. Or to presume to inquire why their lordships have not, at a time like the present, turned their attention to the moral improvement of the Navy, while they have done and are doing so much for the material part of it. Now, the writer is referring to the new technological innovations that are beginning to take place in the Navy, but he notes that these strides forward are increasingly at odds with what's popularly viewed as an outmoded moral laxity. And this concern regarding the corruption of future officers at a young age is also seen in popular novels as well, specifically those of Frederick Marryat, who entered the Navy in 1806 and served under Thomas Cochrane, who was a very dashing officer and whose career was the model for many of Marryat's heroes in his novels. Marryat's first novel, Frank Mildmay, which he wrote during the 1820s and published in 1829, illustrates the ruin of the character of naval officer Mildmay, who attributes this to, quote, his sensual education in the cockpit while he was still a young midshipman. And you can, there we are. This is a print of sailors carousing or a peek into the long room from 1825. And this is very much the idea that people feel that young, impressionable midshipmen, so commissioned officers in training, are actually being thrust into this atmosphere where they're being raised, in essence, if you think Nelson went to sea at the age of 12, and trained in something that is really a morally corrupting atmosphere. Now, certainly it's not a new one. It's something that's voiced throughout the course of the 18th century and throughout the period of Nelson's Navy. But by the 1820s, when you have something like evangelicalism firmly entrenched in mainstream British society, issues around morality and the Navy are at the centre of public debate. Now, given that pamphleteers and writers like Marryat are voicing concerns about the moral atmosphere of the Navy, it's possible that many believed that one way into, which to visually demonstrate improvement of this area is by altering the exterior appearance. Certainly correct dress paired of the excesses of the previous century denotes not only moral uprightness, but the forward-looking vision of the wearer and the organization he represents. Now, certainly another change in terms of modernization of the Navy, which was not altogether well received, certainly not by Byam Martin, was the way in which young midshipmen were educated and the age in which they actually went to sea. This is a Reynolds portrait of 1756 of Admiral Francis Holborn and his son Francis. And little Francis is wearing the midshipman's uniform, so it is quite a nice touch. But also, just to make the point about how naval uniform holds on so long in certain styles, if you can cast your minds back to that early image of the 1821 thing, you can see the links really with these very heavy lapels, all this heavy gold lace, and of course the white facings. Now, as I mentioned, Nelson went to sea at the age of 12 on the HMS Raisonnable under the command of his uncle, Morris Suckling, and Byam Martin's career began in a similar way through social connections. Although Byam Martin's career was combined with the fraudulent practice of entering his name on the books of a ship as a child. And what this means is that on paper, he would have served the 6 years requisite to be eligible for the lieutenant's examination. This in turn meant he's able to sit for an examination at an earlier age and would then be eligible for promotion at an earlier age. The younger that one began to advance through the Navy, the better one's chances of achieving a high rank. So Byam Martin was entered on the books of the Canada at the age of 8 in 1780 while he was at grammar school. In 1782, while at boarding school in Surrey, he was on the books of the Foudroyant. And when he actually did serve afloat in 1786 as a captain's servant to Prince William on the Pegasus, he was already eligible for the lieutenant's examination. So this is very much representative of the old system in the Navy. What's interesting is that in the period immediately following Trafalgar, there's a change to which the way in which midshipmen and cadets were trained. Previously, they went to sea at a young age, like both Byam Martin and Nelson, to learn practical skills in an environment where the public was warned in 1827 in a pamphlet that if you know what a man of war is and what the cockpit of a man of war is, then you know how fearfully at times it resembles what by some has occasionally been denominated a little hell. Now, instead, midshipmen and later cadets were sent to the Royal Navy Academy at Portsmouth and, after 1837, to training ships. This is a Rowlandson print of a midshipman in 1790, and it gives you a sense of what the ideal midshipman should be. Clearly, he's there studying his navigation, and he's got his proper tracts under his arm. The Royal Navy Academy in Portsmouth was founded in 1733, and it was very expensive. Fees were between £70 and £80 per year, and by all accounts, it was very badly run and never full. It admitted only the sons of upper classes, and I love this quote so much by Nicholas Roger, I had to include it, because he said, "It had little impact on the Navy. Whatever the academites learned at their desk, they were not absorbing seamanship or making the vital personal contacts on which their careers would depend. So informed parents tended to avoid it." Now, however, the majority of midshipmen tended to be recruited directly into the Navy following family ties like Nelson or patronage like Byam Martin. And after 1773, the Academy stipulated that fees would be waived for the sons of officers in the Navy as an attempt to bring in more students. Another perk they offered was that the length of service required before sitting a lieutenant's examination would be shortened from 6 to 4 years for all Academy graduates. In 1806, again right after Trafalgar, the Admiralty reformed and expanded the Academy and renamed it the Royal Naval College. It thought that this would be more of a boarding school atmosphere for boys and instead of this morally dangerous environment of the ship. But again, the popular perception of midshipmen to come from Portsmouth was that they're poorly trained and disciplined and that they weren't properly exposed to practical knowledge or its uses. Byam Martin, of course, saw this as part of the general decline of the British naval officer, and he felt that midshipmen went to sea with a good education but absolutely no practical skills. And he was really damning in his view of this new Navy, and he wrote, in his memoirs, the rivalry with midshipmen is no longer in smartness of professional duties, but in frivolous effeminacy, incompatible with what we wish and expect in the character of seamen. And if we do not, above every other consideration, train young men so as to make them real, practical seamen, the consequences may be truly awful to the country. Now, this idea of frivolous effeminacy refers both to the changes in the training of midshipmen and to the new uniform. And so popular print from 1827, just after the new uniform comes in, which is called Things as They Were, 1757, Things as They Are, 1827. And it illustrates what's meant to be a lieutenant wearing the dress of Nelson's Navy. And it's quite lovely because you can see here, his sea chest is absolutely bursting with charts and maps. He's practical, he's ready for war. Behind him is a full-rigged man of war, reinforcing the idea that he is a man of war. He is someone who's going to protect the country. Whereas next to him is the lieutenant of 1827 in the new uniform, with his lovely wasp waist, the exaggerated puff shoulders of a dandy. His sea chest has hair oil and perfumes in it. And behind him is the similarly wasp-waisted, fragile little pleasure craft. Really, it's this idea that the Navy, with this uniform, will be perceived as effeminate dandies who are in no way able to do things like anti-slavery patrols, which of course ties in with being that moral element, as well as defending the nation. Now, the Navy themselves are upset by the loss of the uniform because they feel that they've actually been cut off from Nelson. There's no direct legacy with Nelson anymore. And Byron Martin himself says that he felt that he wore the uniform that Nelson wore when he was at Trafalgar, and that this is no longer the case with the new uniform. Now, finally, as well, the shift to steam, paired with peacetime downsizing, meant that the Royal Navy wasn't building ships of the line anymore. So the implications of this were that the Navy's now a smaller force, it's manned by inferior effeminate officers, and Britain itself is now vulnerable. In 1837, the Royal Naval College at Portsmouth was closed due to a combination of factors. One is largely the downsizing. The other thing is that then, as now, the government was cutting defence spending. And there were debates in Parliament over the fact that the Army appeared to be making serious cuts while the Navy continued spending. Cadets were either trained in training ships, for example, the Beatty, which was set up by the Marine Society and had been in use since 1786, and the Warspit, which was established much later in 1862. There were also smaller establishments. One was run by a man named George Gillett, who was secretary to the Admiralty, a tailor specializing in naval uniform, and also the man who oversaw a lot of the changes to the new naval uniform. Certainly in the 1830s, with unrest in France and Wellington as Prime Minister, parallels were drawn in the press with the period of the French Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars, and the specter of a renewed threat of invasion was raised. Now, a privately published pamphlet of 1838, titled simply The Navy, was circulated with the warning that with the smaller navy and the loss of ships of the line, quote, the wooden walls were thrown down, the country is laid open. An army may land without meeting any resistance whatever, and defenceless must England remain unless her walls are set up again. And of course, in 1838, you've got Turner's, one of his most famous paintings, The Fighting Temeraire, being towed to her berth. And this is to be broken up. So the Temeraire, that was a famous ship, it came to the aid of the Victory at Trafalgar, is now being towed off to be broken up. And it was felt at the time that it was showing the decline of British naval power. This obsolete ship of the line is towed away by a steam-powered tug. So it also illustrates the advance of new technology as steam replaces the old sailing navy. Now, a rebuttal to the accusations that were printed in the Navy appeared in 1839 in a pamphlet authored by Lord Minto, the first Lord Commissioner of the Admiralty. And Minto swept aside what he saw as the misplaced faith in wooden walls, and he boldly outlines the future of the Navy under the advent of steam power. He says, it appears that our empire has far more cause to hope than apprehension from the ascendancy of steam in naval affairs. We may expect, however, that some time will elapse before this truth is generally admitted. Men's minds will be loath to receive so momentous a conversion of that of the comparative inutility of ships of the line. And Minto stated quite clearly the need for modernization within the Navy and the role that steam would play as a new technology, as well as highlighting how outmoded the old willing sailing ship had become. Now, certainly by 1830, so really I'm pushing the envelope on the long 18th century at this point, these three strands, technology, uniform, and education, built on each other to engender a type of public hysteria in regard to the Navy. It's this idea that Britain is vulnerable, her Navy is an ever-decreasing number of ships of the line, manned by poorly trained dandies. The one naval identity where actually the three strands sit comfortably together is, interestingly enough, of that of Polar Explorer. And you have this rather dramatic image of the HMS Erebus passing through a chain of bergs, and this is from 1842. Certainly, these naval expeditions aren't new. Those of Cook in the 1770s were celebrated, and even Nelson, as a young midshipman, took part in Phipps' polar expedition. This is an image of it where he famously attempts to capture a polar bear for its skin. This is by Richard Westall. It's from 1806. This event is mythologized in an early biography of Nelson. And certainly it's one of a series of popular prints that's reproduced illustrating scenes from his life. However, these early 18th century voyages were actually eclipsed by the Royal Navy's achievement in the Arctic and Antarctic from the 1820s and 40s. Exploration meant the expansion of empire, really, and contributed to Britain's intellectual and cultural cachet abroad. Certainly an Admiralty proposal of 1828 outlines the goals of the expedition, which would sustain the high esteem which England at present occupies among the civilized nations of the world through the advancement of science. Now, one example of the new naval hero is James Clark Ross, looking very dishy here in his uniform. And he discovered what they thought at the time was the magnetic North Pole in June 1831. This 1834 portrait of Ross shows him resplendent in his dress uniform. In 1830, I should add that Prince William did actually change part of the uniform. He changed the cuffs and collar from white to red, which caused more outcries over dandyism. However, what's interesting is that the refinement of Ross's full dress uniform is tempered by this bearskin thrown over it, possibly implying that the masculinity of the Arctic explorer is an antidote to the perception of the overly refined dandies of the Navy. Further, a comparison could also be made with the image of Nelson and the bear, this idea that where Nelson failed to get his bear for its skin, Ross succeeded and got his bear skin. It's the one way, really, in the post-Trafalgar period that the Navy are able to surpass the legacy of Nelson. Thank you.
I'm not quite sure how the best way logistically to do questions is. Do you think we should pull some chairs forward?
Yeah.
Or perch on this table, or what do you guys think? You happy?
Let's
just get you guys to jump up for a moment, if that's okay. So my job as the chair is to try to get you to talk to each other about your various subjects. Thank you, Adrian. There's one which you want to. So I guess the easiest way to do that is to ask, course, what seems to me a very obvious question is that were the Royal Navy uniforms made of cotton?
They were not, unfortunately. They weren't. They were they're wool, but what was interesting is when John was talking about the cotton linen blends, the linings are actually consistently either a cotton linen blend or a wool and linen blend. So again, it's that idea that you don't get cotton both ways in the Royal Navy uniform. But even within, say, the bits that you don't see, so the backs of waistcoats and things like that, where they're using, where they're not using wool, they're using sort of lighter fabrics, you don't get that. What you do get sometimes, though, which is quite interesting, is that they're mad about personalizing their uniform, as you would expect. And so what you get are non-regulation fabrics and clothes being used. And Nelson, of course, is notorious. Nelson's waistcoat that he was wearing when he was shot is actually cotton both ways.
I was just
how people would sort of use that moment to sort of demonstrate social wealth and responsibility in a way that they couldn't do because there was this system of non-commissioned sort of officers and hierarchy. So do you think that when people are using cotton both ways, cotton is to demonstrate that not only are you, I'm also socially higher than you, even though you might be the same rank in the Navy. Do you think that sort of happens?
It's hard to say.
Like you've got more, because you can put gold everywhere, but there must be sort of, do you have it in the back of the column?
It's hard to say. What you tend to get, if they're trying to do that, because you paid for your uniform, the Navy didn't supply it, so you had to buy everything. What you tend to get is clearly with certain officers where they will line their collars with velvet or with silk, so they'll actually use really high-end fabrics to do that. And I know certainly from records, thinking of someone like John Borlase Warren, who was of high social standing, who also got an enormous amount of prize money during the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars period. He actually did have his collars specially lined. The other thing that he used to do in the 1770s, and that they all did when they got the chance, was to wear epaulettes, which were not part of the regulation. But the army had them, yeah, the gold bits on your shoulder. The army had them, and the French had them, and so that seemed to be enough reason for the Navy to want them. And they did, finally, in 1795, they did introduce them into regulations. But certainly Nelson is very sniffy about captains wearing them who shouldn't, pre-regulations.
Isn't that partly what's going on here? I'm struck. Let me go back, wind back one, which is that Scott Marley's book, which is a book about army uniforms in the early 19th century, which I think is a terrific book, argues that that's the period when army uniforms become most elaborate. Not just, I mean, in Britain, but also all over Europe. That's when you get the extraordinary elaboration of bearskins and, you know, knit waists and all sorts of add-ons and these kind of hussar uniforms, the whole bit. And that thinking about how dress often works, it seems to me that a lot of what's going on with these new uniforms, these naval uniforms, is a kind of desperate attempt on somebody's part. I mean, interesting who, maybe the tailors, maybe the king, whatever, the royal naval people, to keep up with the army, because the army is just going completely over the top.
Go mad, but the Navy pares it right down, and
right.
They actually get rid of dress and undress for a bit, so you just have one.
Right.
So you've got one uniform, and it is paired straight back. I mean, if you look at that... Sorry, I can just
sure.
go back to... if you look at... where is it? This one. I mean, this is the 1821 uniform, which is really a continuation of the 1795 pattern. So it's really very much an 18th century one, and they pare it down to that, which is just really, it is much more pared down. You lose a huge amount of the gold lace from the cuffs, from the collar, from the lapels. So they actually, interestingly enough, just pare it down. There are comments made in Parliament that the Navy is wearing these short little coats and these plain little coats all of a sudden, and what has happened? So so it is interesting. Unfortunately, again, there are no extant records whatsoever. I've been through everything you can possibly go through, including the rough minutes of the meetings around this, and there's nothing to say why they did it. So it's not clear, and really then a lot of it is clearly just conjecture as far as we can go. But it is just a much plainer, simpler uniform, and when you see them in the flesh, you do see the big difference in the tailoring, in the way that it's made. Now, the Marines, on the other hand, go mad, and they do get much much more gaudy uniforms, lots of gold frogging and lace and things like that. Again, what's interesting is they all go for these tiny, tiny little waists, which and incredibly tight clothing, which persists throughout this first half of the 19th century. So when you see photographs of Franklin in the Franklin expedition, you have someone like Sir John Franklin, who's elderly and portly, who's just wedged into a uniform, and the buttons are straining in the photographs. So they're brilliant because paintings, clearly all this portraiture is how it should look ideally and what you're aspiring to. Whereas with the Franklin photograph, there is that gap between what it should look like and what it looks like. And so you do get that. But the thing is, it is interesting with the Navy in that they do pare it right down, they do go right back. It is a much plainer, much simpler uniform. These, for example, this is an admiral, so I've tried to bring up really two ranks, two uniforms of the same rank, so you can see the difference. And they're both the dress uniform. But certainly, captains and lieutenants still have a great deal of lace. They have it on their hats. They have it really everywhere that they can get it. And the problem is, of course, it's incredibly expensive as well. And it tarnishes. And you have to take your dress uniform to sea, even though you might never wear it because it's ceremonial. And so you have all these tin trunks that take up room on a ship where there isn't room. And then when you do pull it out to wear it at the art court-martial, the lace is tarnished and there's no way to clean it. And so it just becomes, they want these uniforms, but on the other hand, it becomes a bit of a disaster as well for them. And all they do is complain to the Admiralty constantly that either they don't have them or they do have them, but it's expensive. So
perhaps a sort of underlying theme here to both your sort of stories is practicality in a way. So this sort of sizing down whilst we regard it to be something is perhaps the Navy becoming more serious in a time when it's trying to be, even it's being ridiculed in pamphlets and the press is sort of failing after Nelson. And perhaps your story of how we change our production and manufacture, and then actually what cotton is entirely in itself is all to do with the practicality of printing on it and the practicality of keeping it clean at sea.
Yeah.
Interesting continuity. But I will jump up and open the floor to questions because I think you really that's the
So if anyone has any other questions for either of the speakers, we'll start here at the front.
Can I ask, is there any parallel to be made between the development of uniforms in the East India Company and the Navy?
There is. In fact, there's a back and forth between the Navy and the East India Company.
Like a rivalry.
There is, yes. And the Navy gets their first uniforms in 1748. Those are the first uniform regulations, which are only for commissioned officers. And the East India Company, I think it's slightly later that theirs come in. And they're both blue indigo dyed wool with gold lace on them. And the East India Company starts wearing red waistcoats that are gold laced as well. So they are quite fabulous, really. And the Navy, officers in the Navy write very sarky letters to the Admiralty saying, essentially, these merchantmen are far better dressed than we are. We better do something about it. And so the Admiralty does send letters out. First of all, the East India Company has to tone down their dress. And secondly, the Navy makes sure that they get, really, again, the more flamboyant of the two dress uniforms. But what's interesting is throughout the 18th century, the East India Company is wearing blue and white as well. So they're wearing white waistcoats, laced with gold lace or gold embroidery, and then a blue coat. And eventually this does change, certainly by the very end of the 18th century, early 19th century. They're wearing really quite fabulous uniforms. They're sort of that blue-black wool with velvet collars and velvet lapels and silver twist lace sewn on. So they do develop a pace with each other, and they are keeping an eye on who's doing what as well. There is a rivalry, just as there's a rivalry between the Army and Navy on uniforms, and who gets epaulettes and who gets what, because they're very keen that uniform, in all cases, distinguish them as being in service in some way, in something that they're... So the Navy, for example, feels that it needs a uniform to show that it's in service to the Crown, so that it gets the respect both abroad and at home that it deserves. And the East India Company is also very keen, the officers, because they want something to distinguish them as well.
I really enjoy these papers. I've got a question first for John and then one for Amy. I think one of the really interesting things is just how long it took for Arkwright's machinery to be introduced.